audio storytelling has become increasingly popular, with many taking to the microphone to share their voices, opinions, and stories through the spoken word. But it isn't just about personal expression. Podcasting connects people and can be an outlet for those underserved by traditional media. I'm Meg Wilcox, and you're listening to the Community Podcast Initiative, or the CPI. And the goal of the CPI is to produce and promote podcasting as a way to amplify underrepresented voices through audio storytelling. This initiative is based out of Mount Royal University and powered by Shaw. For today's episode, I'm joined by Kyle Napier. So Kyle and I work together on this really neat project based out of the CPI. It's called the Canadian Mountain Podcast, and we oversee a team of six brilliant research assistants who serve as hosts and producers for the show. These students are all undergrads with MRU's journalism program, and while we support them along the way, the students pitch, research, prepare, record, host, and edit the episodes as a team, which gives them great hands-on learning experience in terms of all aspects of production.
It's not just about the audio production. As you know, the focus on the show, other than sharing research about Canada's mountain ecosystems, is also about the learning behind the scenes as well. The podcast team, along with other research teams from the Canadian Mountain Network, must also be sensitive, respectful, and have tact when they're including Indigenous perspectives on land and knowledge systems, and blending those Indigenous knowledge systems with settler perspectives also. The podcast team themselves are a mix of settler and Indigenous students, and there's a bit of dialogical learning happening between these production pairs. I'm particularly appreciative of the contributions from the Indigenous knowledge holders and land users who are interviewed as guests, who share the perspectives of their communities and their community Indigenous research methodologies. But bringing it back to the team, the team of podcasters has also had to take on their own bit of learning regarding decolonizing podcasting and podcast platforms. For example, although the podcasters developed land acknowledgements, each of the podcasters remained committed to learning more about the land as it relates to them and the treaties. Decolonization, as we know, doesn't begin or end at land acknowledgements, and you get a sense of that from the podcast team here. The learners have had the opportunity to share their land acknowledgement processes in an article on JSource, as well as through presentations at the university and beyond.
And so, you know, it really is a mix of journalism, research, and knowledge mobilization. And this is all done with our partner, the Canadian Mountain Network, and they're based out of the University of Alberta. So that means there's also this sort of client relationship with the Mountain Network as our team delivers one of their key public-facing outputs. So there's a lot of moving parts, I think it's fair to say, with this project. And the program's been running since 2019, though it's grown and shifted over the past couple of years. I was overseeing the project since 2019. Kyle, you joined us in 2021, fall 2021. And this spring, we're saying goodbye to three of our senior students. They're graduating, leaving for new and exciting projects. And that's Gabrielle Piska, Eric Tanner, and Ethan Ward. And they joined the Canadian Mountain Podcast team in the summer of 2020. So we sat down with the three of them to learn more about their experiences being part of this podcasting research team, what they've learned, and what they will take away from their 2 years working with the team. So thank you so much for joining me. And before we sort of get into the meat and bones of the conversation today, I was wondering if we could just do a round of introductions of who's here, and we'll start with Kyle.
Thank you, Meg. Sazi Kyle Napier Silie, Tibachan Oslur Kulu, Ju Chudon Shet Chuanare Nostler. I'm really excited to talk about the key learnings in the last few years around the Canadian Mountain Podcast and the Canadian Mountain Network and your experiences here. So just appreciative to be an attentive and listening ear. Merci.
Hello, my name is Ethan Ward. I am a fourth-year journalism student here at Mount Royal University, and I've been working with the Canadian Mountain Podcast for 2 years.
I'm Eric Tanner. I'm a fourth-year journalism student here at Mount Royal University as well.
Yeah, hello. My name is Gabrielle Piska. I'm a fourth and final year journalism student. Same as Eric and Ethan, I've been on this podcast for two and a half years now.
Wonderful. One thing that kind of happened, I think, a bit organically was the research project that you all worked on around land acknowledgments and podcasts. And this started a bit, actually it did start with Sarah Buffalo, who was also part of the team last year. Pointing out, you know, are we going to have a land acknowledgement? And this led to, I know we brought in Patty Derbyshire and Spirit River Striped Wolf, who at the time was the student union president, to talk a bit about land acknowledgements. And from there, you did your own research and had group conversations and worked towards developing a few layers, I would say, of land acknowledgement for our podcast. But then it also turned into an article that you wrote for JSource that was published last year. And so I'm curious about your thoughts on this research project. Was it of value? What stuck out for you? How did it feel? How do you feel that it enhanced the podcasting side of what we did?
I'd say tenfold. Like going into this, I'd heard land acknowledgements like the odd time at, I think, business meetups, like that was, or business conferences. That was the limit to what it was. I'd never heard it on TV. I'd never heard it at a sporting event. And it's weird to think that just 2 years ago, they're nowhere, where it seems like for the better, they're becoming a lot more omnipresent. But at the time, we didn't really have a lot to work with, just to build a base off of. So I think Sarah really bringing that forward was not only good to get us thinking about like what's our guests, what the land we were working on meant to us while working with the Canadian Mountain Podcast, especially with, you know, being the Canadian Mountain Podcast, we're talking about all of these lands, which are treated and very important to so many of our guests, as we've strived to have all the Indigenous representation on for the voices that otherwise you sometimes just don't get heard.
I think it was also necessary as an extension of the values of the network itself, because I think going in, not specifically land acknowledgements, but just wanting to have, as Eric said, have that Indigenous voice and get the voices of people who are not often heard on the podcast. And then I think the land acknowledgement was a logical and necessary stepping stone on the road towards just representing the values of the network as a whole.
When I first went into journalism, I remember something that kind of stuck with me, which was just that when you want to write a good article, emphasis on a good article, you want to have, to a degree, a certain amount of knowledge about what you're talking about when you're writing. And so I think that when we first got approached to write this article, I felt timid because I felt I didn't know nearly as much as I needed to write this. And so I think that it challenged my writing abilities to be able to look past and to research and to hear from other perspectives and to kind of look beyond myself and then come back with my own reflections, and being able to write in that style really challenged me. But I think also with land acknowledgements, like very similar to what Eric and Ethan said, like that's not something you heard at all. Like I rarely heard. I heard it in academic settings, in big meetings, and that was it. And I think that it can kind of come across as that monotone, doesn't actually, like just something you're checking off the box. But I think that when Sarah came in and we were very much like, we don't know how to start, we don't know where to begin. And her first question was, well, what does this land mean to you? That has always stuck with me. Because for the first time, it wasn't just writing a script to get by. It wasn't just, you know, saying the words and going through the motions. It made me stop and think, like, wow, like I live in this awesome place. I can go to the Rocky Mountains whenever I want. I am in an institution that I get to work and do school with all the time. And it was the first time that I stopped and I was like, I have a lot to appreciate about this land. Like, this land is awesome. There's so many cool things. We have a national park inside of Calgary. Well, not a national park, but a park inside of our Calgary that it's just interesting. And so it was the first time that I really stopped and reflected and was able to just write about home. And I think that that was valuable in and of itself, one of the most valuable things that I learned.
From my perspective, one of the things I really enjoyed was the discussions around acknowledgements or statements, but they should be rooted in intention and action. And one of the things that did shift in the podcast production was how we do interviews, right? So one of the things that we start now is asking someone where they're from and their connection to the land and their story, which isn't how many journalistic interviews start, especially if you're doing daily news. And additionally, to shift our questions to be considerate of other forms of knowledge, right? To be reflective on our language, not always getting it right, but making an effort to be specific and be accurate in our knowledge from a researched and considered way when we're working with people from different backgrounds. And that's something I think we'll get into in a little bit. But I think for me, what I loved about, you know, thinking about land acknowledgements is not only is it something you can hear on our podcast, it's actually something that you might not know shifted how we went about doing it, right? How we frame those cue lines and those conversations. But I want to jump a bit, shifting into year two, I would say, of the project. I know we've talked a lot about year one, but I think it sort of talked a bit about the foundations and where it's come from. But as you pointed out, Ethan, there was already an intention and an expectation of including Indigenous knowledge in the podcast. But due to a shift from the Canadian Mountain Network themselves, it became a much bigger goal of the podcast. And I know I can honestly say I was sitting there thinking, well, I can't run this on my own, which is when I reached out to you, Kyle, thinking that we wanted, you know, how could we actually turn this into an opportunity to learn more about at the time the Mountain Network was starting to use the term braiding knowledge, right? So bringing in both settler or academic or Western, whatever term you might want to use, knowledge, while also including Indigenous perspectives and knowledge. And there were a few things that shifted with the project, but Kyle, I was wanting to get your thoughts, you know, when I reached out to you about this project and sort of what we were looking to accomplish, what do you remember or what stuck out for you and why did you say yes?
Well, yeah, just reflecting on the process that you as producers have conducted and how you've gone about mobilizing the knowledges and the stories with both the Indigenous knowledge holders and the researchers as collaborators in the storytelling process. What I'm most fascinated with is the avenue of podcasting as an accessible form of media about that research when typically published research is either behind a paywall or is simply written in language that you know, affected communities might not use to speak about that issue. And so it's an inaccessible language about the very topics that affect the communities that are being talked about. And so what catalyzed my own interest in wanting to join the Canadian Mountain Podcast in any capacity, beyond just being nosy about what is being done behind the scenes of this production, is also to develop more of an intimate process orientation on my own conduct in both teaching and running my own podcasts outside of this one. And so, you know, speaking of, you know, themes of transferability of skills and process and podcasting as an avenue in the many dynamisms of the media fora, I'm really just interested to hear right from all three of you around process and practices, particularly in second year, right, when Indigenous guests, knowledge holders and elders have been, and there's the commitment to continually include such guests. So just reflecting around that, best practices, processes, and for the politeration, patience as protocol too. So curious if what the thoughts are here.
You know, maybe a way we can start talking about that is, I'd say the first shift that came from you joining, Kyle, which was fantastic, is that the first thing we did coming back in the new year was go over the land acknowledgements that had been produced the year prior with a fine-tooth comb, and I mean that in the best way possible, really breaking down the language, and we ended up changing and shifting it. And I'm wondering, what was that process like for you?
I think it was good, and I think it was needed. I think that if we had had one land acknowledgement for 2.5 years and didn't look at how we could change it and refine it, we wouldn't be really true to not only the article we wrote, but the land acknowledgement in and of itself, and the idea that, like you mentioned, Meg, it's just a statement, but behind it is that action. And I don't think we would have been true to the action if we weren't willing to learn and adapt and change as we go. So I think that when Kyle joined and he really fine-tuned the land acknowledgement, there were so many times where I was like, oh, yeah, that makes so much sense. That's such a good idea. Like, we need to, of course. And it just broadened my knowledge that, you know, you don't ever get to a point in an internship or a job where you kind of hit that peak and you know everything. To be open-minded and that you're always learning, you're always changing. Nothing is ever 100%. You always want to see how you can improve. And I think seeing that dynamic in the process is really going to help me going forward in the future to always be open and willing to learn, which is a skill that not employers, but everyone should aspire to have.
Yeah, I can say that, well, I think we were all very proud of that first land acknowledgement that we had produced. It was a difficult process to go past, like, our very settler perspectives, at least for us three at the table here. But I think, you know, it was a valiant effort for what it was. But I think what was most important was Kyle came in here and he gave us, like, not just what we had that made it personal, but he also brought in what could make it personal in a way that was in a much more respectable manner, where I believe that our land acknowledgement was improved tenfold by coming in. And, you know, maybe we thought this was good at the time, but, you know, why don't we get another perspective on this? We had not only your perspective, but we also had the newbie perspective, and we also had our own perspective after our hiatus for a little bit, where we could go look back on it, see any potential mix-ups that we had or anything that we thought we could improve. Because, you know, going back, listening to anything you've done years ago, you realize, you nitpick yourself. You're like, oh, I could have phrased that one question better. I could have voiced a bit better. But yeah, and I think that was just essentially the same process we went through with the land acknowledgement.
I think of the expression getting comfortable being uncomfortable, right? I think any of this navigation, there's never a right way to do it, like 100% right way to do it. And so part of it is navigating and working on that. But Kyle, I know I sort of co-opted your question there. I don't know if you wanted to reframe or come in and weigh in on anything.
Well, I super appreciated that you did reframe it in a way that was, speaking of digestibility. And it has me interested in another follow-up question, which is tips that you would offer to others who are developing their own land acknowledgements, you know, thinking about your experiences, the key learnings, even just in a quick bundle of thought, what tips would you offer others working on theirs?
So I think this could kind of go both ways, but look up a bunch of examples of land acknowledgements to try and, like, look up like for good examples and then bad examples. But then also importantly, like, it's not just like enough for somebody to say, okay, this is a good example and this is a bad example. I think you should try and go through each one on your own and try and figure out for yourself why one is good and why one is bad. Like I said earlier, look at the words used, look at the language and say, okay, do I understand why this land acknowledgement is good and this one is bad? I think that would be, like, helpful, like, just to do that on your own. And then I don't know if this is an option for everybody, but then get together in a group and discuss.
A tip I would give is go in and mess it up. And I say that honestly, because before I took on this internship, I felt really timid and in that, like, I was so scared to mess it up. I didn't want to touch it at all. I didn't want to go and work in kind of areas like that because I was just so scared. I didn't want to be that reporter that got canceled, and I just didn't want to mess it up. And I think that that really hindered my ability to learn. And I think that when going into this internship, going in and the first few drafts was like, oh no, that is not good. And then being able to refine it, it's part of the learning process. So I think that that fear is only going to, like, hinder you. And at the end of the day, it's better to go in and mess up than not to try at all. And so go in with an open mind and willingness to learn, but that if you mess up, it's okay. And you can learn going forward, and to just go in full heartedly, as much of the 100% as you can, and really be genuine. Cause I think as long as you're trying, you're in the right direction.
I'd say if you're looking to take inspiration from others, which is a great place to start, steal the ideas and the structure, but don't steal the content. Like, if you're going through and you're listening to other land acknowledgements, and you hear a formatting that works, like kind of a listing order, that can be great. But also be sure to just put your own personal flair on it and don't just put in all the prerequisites that you necessarily need to.
Just to add what Eric and Ethan said, I think if you're going to do your research, look up Indigenous land acknowledgements and Indigenous resources. I think that if you're looking at Indigenous resources, that's going to be a lot better than looking up some podcast of just, or someone of that is completely of settler perspective and probably butchered the pronunciation and things like that. I think that it's also a great opportunity to be able to learn more about the Indigenous resources that are out there versus just kind of taking off only settler perspective.
It does hit on the key theme of reflexivity and revisiting your process and knowing that you will mess it up and just being committed to reevaluating those land acknowledgements and reevaluating your own commitments to the communities that you're acknowledging through this land acknowledgement. So again, just reflexivity as a necessary component to collaborative engagement with Indigenous communities.
So one of the most recent activities we were able to do, and we finally did get out for a field trip just about a month ago, Kyle, you were able to organize for us an opportunity to go to Stoney Nakoda and to meet with Elder Tom Snow to have a meal. We were able to go out onto the land and to sit, and we were able to partake in a smudging ceremony. I know for many of us that was the first time, and to hear stories, have Elder Tom Snow share his perspective with us. And I guess, you know, Kyle, from your perspective, bringing the group out to meet an elder that you have, relatively longstanding connection with at this point, you've been developing that relationship. What was the experience like for you?
Sure. And I'll just paint the scene for the listening audience. So we at the Canadian Mountain Podcast are situated on the lands in Mokinstis or Winchispa or Kutsisau, colonially referred to as Calgary. And so we made the trip out as a convoy in two vehicles, and we headed out to Morley and Iyahi Nakoda lands and Stoney Nakoda First Nation. And we went to what I might assume is the world's nicest Smitty's, and we grabbed a lunch courtesy of the Canadian Mountain Podcast. So shout outs and gratitude there. And from there, Elder Tom Snow came in, and before he sat with us, he sat with his son, who happened to be at that Smitty's. So it was great to see the familial transgenerational connections in that way. So then Elder Tom Snow and his wife joined and sat with us, and another colleague of mine, Alec Carton, came and sat with us, and we did what Dr. Cindy Janice Gaudette would refer to as visiting as methodology, which is so critical in the space of Indigenous podcasting or broadcasting or media-making relationships, is not visiting for the sake of production, but visiting for the sake of pre-production, right? Protocol as a necessary element in that pre-productive process. And so from the Smitty's, we went out and maybe half an hour, 20 minutes in some direction, which I'll only vaguely reference, to the space where they are reintroducing bison to their natural grazing grounds. And so there we were, surrounded by bugs and giant poops of quadrupeds, and sat with grass in our fingertips and ants crawling up our legs and mosquitoes at our ears, to hear Elder Tom Snow, him not being the mosquito in our ears, but to hear Elder Tom Snow share stories and ceremony related to the land. So just for those who if you weren't able to make it, that was the setting. And you know, we were curious how long we should wait there, you know, whether until sunset or wherever. But then parks rangers or folks with responsibility to the area ushered us out shortly after Elder Tom Snow left. So that was the experience. It's always good to again engage in visiting as methodology prior to recording, and you know, a necessary part of our engagement as media makers is sometimes to put the recorder down and just exist and saturate and live in the environments that we're talking about.
And I think that there's something very awkward for journalists, and I know for me often, to go somewhere without your recorder in hand. But I know it was so enjoyable. And to know that this is part of relationship building, and that we think, you know, some of the limitations sometimes with journalism is you're not going to get great stories from people that you've just put a recorder in their face, right? So when we have the time to build relationships, that's where the really great stories can be shared, perhaps at a later time, perhaps not, but you have time to engage in the moment. What was it like to sit and hear Elder Tom Snow stories?
I guess sort of, in a way, it was sort of natural as a journalist, because that's kind of your job as a journalist usually, is to sit back and listen to people tell stories. I guess it was in a different sense that it was good to not have the pressure of like being worried about like record, like you were mentioning, like recording stuff and getting people to, or just like just making sure everything's working right, like your batteries, SD cards and all that. Just that made it more casual isn't the right word, because I think it was like a very, it was an event that had like meaning, and we were like learning some important stuff about the area, and that was important to the people living there. But it was just like freeing, I suppose, to just like sit back and act, like hear stories, but not have to worry about like recording them and like allowing you to like soak it in more. Because I guess like in a way, when you're doing an interview and you're like worried about the recording process, sometimes, at least for me, I don't know about everybody else, sometimes I can maybe not soak in everything immediately, just because like I'm worried about other stuff and like I'm worried about my questions. And then like after I've re-listened to it is like when I'm like more like in tune with it. But I think when we were sitting there outdoors and just like kind of like soaking everything, like also the setting, like, you know, just being like outside and like being in the actual place where the stories were being told about, I think was great.
It was a really tranquil experience, and it was incredibly nice to just be there listening to the stories rather than listening to how the stories are going to sound on my device. It was such an experience to just sit back, hear these stories, and especially it was interesting to be in a journal, be here on like a journalistic setting, be here on journalistic work, but not record anything minus ambient sound. I've never had an experience like that before, and yeah, it was difficult to have to put it away sometimes, put away the recorder, but I'd say it was overall a wonderful experience.
And I guess that leads me to think, over the past 2 years, with the work that you've done, the experts that you've spoken to, the training experiences and the conversations that we've had as a group on everything from land acknowledgements to being able to meet elders, to speak with Indigenous experts, how has your perspective changed? What will you take forward from this experience in working with Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous experts?
I will say it's given me a new perspective on how to phrase a lot of my questions and how to sort of write in a manner that's just not incredibly settler or one-dimensional. You can, with a lot of the ways that we've learned to write and we've been able to workshop, go through, have everyone basically throughout the organization, whether it be our group, the new group, Blaze, you two, look over questions and just think, well, yeah, you've written it and you can see the perspective where you're coming from, but how can we expand this into a way where, you know, a listener like me who's white will understand the full scope of it rather than just like what I already have as my closed mind thought of what the answer is going to be, what's going to occur there.
I guess thinking a bit about how am I going to bring up these topics in a new workplace, like when I go and get like a full-time job and like some journalistic capacity, hopefully, like what Eric was talking about, the questions, like a thing that we started doing was sharing our questions ahead of time with guests, which is not, like we've talked about this a lot, but that's not something you generally do in journalism. And it's like, how am I going to approach that and bring that topic up with like other, like people, like employers or people who are above me? And then like, how receptive are they going to be? How am I going to make them? Well, not like make them, but how am I just going to like get them to listen about these sort of things? Like, and then also like trying to just adapt what we did into new spaces and like trying to find, just as an example, like when is it going to be appropriate to share questions with people beforehand? Like sometimes like that's not going to be a thing. Like if you're like, I think we've talked about this before, but if you're interviewing like a politician or something like that, like, yeah, you're not going to share questions ahead of time, but like if your employer is like receptive to it, like how are you going to work with them to make changes? Like how am I going to make sure that what we've learned and what we've done carries forward?
Absolutely. You know, as you've identified there, the difference between accountability interviews and interviewing for understanding, I think, are two very different purposes, right? And how we prepare and how we share information with individuals varies because of that. Any thoughts, Gabby?
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts. I think I've learned so much that it's kind of hard to put into words sometimes. But earlier in the conversation, I mentioned that
it was in your podcasting class that I kind of fell in love with audio, but I was just dipping my toe in the water. But taking this internship, now fully submerged, I can kind of say I'm a fangirl of audio and I'm a fangirl of podcasting, only because podcasting allows for a medium that just is so much more authentic sometimes than writing and telling stories. And Kyle mentioned it, that academic research can be hard to digest for a lot of community members. And I think that where I loved writing because I loved people and I loved stories, and that each person has a million stories they could tell, I think audio has just opened up almost like these floodgates of the way that you can tell stories and the way that you can listen and receive stories. And I think that at the end of the day, like, the biggest thing that I've learned was that, you know, something you can't capture in like writing and is things like laughter and the way that someone tells a story and the way that they say it audibly. And I think that especially with Indigenous knowledge holders, that's something that's so important. Whether it's the timeline in which they're telling it or the context you need before telling the main point of the story, things like that, that's not something that I would ever want to do an interview and then try to write in a written article, because you would just lose all essence of it. And so I think that podcasting is a way that captures people and stories in general. And I think that that's my biggest takeaway, is how much I love it and how much more accessible it can be, and how there's a whole world of accessible ways to tell stories. People just have to look for it.
And so I think the big question that, you know, this long conversation is working up to is, you're all about to graduate, you're leaving the RA ship. What are you going to take with you? Whether it's memories, whether it's skills, what are you going to take with you and use in the future? What's gonna stick with you?
I think two things I'm going to take with me. One is the skills, so being able to interview remotely, being able to work with panel interviews, being able to change the way that we do reporting. And I think that those skills I'll take with me, but also the mindset of always wanting to learn and change, and the mindset of being open, the mindset of willing to make mistakes, the mindset of being able to do things head first and sometimes make mistakes, but sometimes it turns out great. And I think that, yes, the skills are good, but the mindset that I've had throughout this podcast has adapted so many of my soft skills that I think I'm going to hold with me forever. Being patient and listening to people's stories, knowledge mobilization, and yeah, just my mindset about it is really what I think I'm going to take away.
Yeah, I think a little bit of what I talked about earlier about wherever I move on to, adapting this, like what we've worked on, like, is all of this stuff, am I going to be able to carry it over? I think that's the one huge thing that I'm going to, like, everything that Gabby talked about, like the skills and the mindset, like, I might have that, but I got to be careful that I move on to someplace that is also has that sort of mindset, or is at least receptive to it. Focusing on making sure this wasn't just like a one and done thing and then slipping back into the way things used to be, and like trying to be part of the change and hoping people are receptive to everything that we've talked about and everything that we've learned over the course of the RA ship.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I think we are sort of taking those skills forward in a way where I think all of us worked on Article 1 through MRU, which, shout out, just got published. And, you know, with the podcast in that, we were using a lot of the same methods that we were when we were creating the Canadian Mountain podcast. It wasn't just like us being like, okay, we're going to take the same land acknowledgement, just copy paste it in. We went through, we had a meeting as a whole group to discuss how we should alter it for a different setting, different types of interviews, but still keeping the what made that land acknowledgement special, and sort of formatting in a way that fits better and fits towards a podcast with a different audience and a different topic. So I think we've already been doing that in a way.
I just wanted to add one more thing in closing to what Eric and Ethan said. It just brought forth an idea that we have these skills and we're moving forward with them. But like Ethan mentioned, not all places of work have these same values and have these same skills. And I think that not only me graduating from the podcast, but me graduating in general, I've kind of realized that we're the next generation of journalists. We're the next generation of leaders that are going to put forth change. So being able not only to take away these skills, but maybe having, I want to say bravery, but I don't know if bravery is the right word, but taking having the bravery and having the willpower to not only take away these skills, but look at changing the status quo of journalism and look at changing the way we go about things. And I think that if we can take these skills and start to change the way that we see journalism, it's going to end in a way that's going to be so much better for community members, for journalism in general. And I think that what the step one is taking these skills away. Step two is being able to share them and engage with other journalists in the world so that we can begin to move in a way that's going to be more compassionate reporting.
Gabby, you really addressed it well when you said that the face and the conduct of media and journalism practice is changing. And right now, as you're listening to the generation of new and upcoming digital storytellers, journalists, media makers, content creators, that these are the folks that are also challenging an industry of media making that that perhaps not everyone has been agreeable with so far, you know, and despite anyone's politics or backgrounds, being able to listen and listen attentively is what brings us together, and being able to understand is what allows us to see with another person's perspective and through their eyes. And so podcasting is one of, again, the forums for doing so, but it does take challenging an industry, and it does take working with holocratic instead of hierarchical media practices to ensure equitable parity in spaces for people whose voices have been excluded from the larger broadcast media. So it's just really interesting to see not only what's happening in the space of podcasting, broadcasting, and media, but also the individuals who are taking the actions to make those changes. So just very excited for what emerges for all of you as you take your next steps as journalists and communications practitioners.
That was Gabrielle Piska, Eric Tanner, and Ethan Ward, three of the outgoing researchers and producers with the Canadian Mountain podcast team they joined in the spring of 2020. And so, Kyle, I'm curious about your thoughts from the interview, because the funny thing is, as instructors, as facilitators, as mentors, we can always have hopes or goals for the team, but we really don't control the outcomes here. And so I'm curious, you know, based on the discussion and the experience we've had this year, what do you think should be our goals as we continue this project next year?
Well, thank you, Meg. It was really a great opportunity to hear from the podcasters and their reflections over not just this last year, but their time throughout the Canadian Mountain podcast. Some things I'd really like to see as we change forms and go through our transitions in journalism would be to consider decolonial practices towards rematriation and reattribution of Indigenous intellectual properties, something that has certainly been acknowledged in the global space of intellectual properties, are the lack of provisions made regarding community intellectual property rather than individual intellectual property. So what happens when we bring a guest onto the show is that the podcasters, or we retain intellectual property for the interview. We retain the copyright. So I'd really be interested in seeing if we can rematriate that copyright to the guests and the knowledge holders and the researchers, frankly, who are joining us. Some other goals I have for next year include developing a bit more of a reliable publishing schedule and working much more in advance in a relational way with the plurality of guests who are joining us on the show. So I know that, you know, not only do land users and Indigenous knowledge holders have schedules that require them outside of the bureaucracy and administrative confines of time. So if someone has a commitment to ceremony and they have to be at that ceremony for the next 3 years at that specific time, we have to acknowledge and work with that. Mm-hmm. In the same way, knowing that researchers have conference schedules or teaching schedules. And so we have to work with a variety of overlapping and sometimes conflicting schedules. So I'd like to make sure that we have the opportunity to work with our sources in advance and have that reliable, comfortable recording structure, which really helps to build trust with the folks that we're bringing in on the show.
Well, and that's one of the challenges, I feel, that is, you know, we are intermediaries in some ways for the Mountain Network, and we don't necessarily know these individuals. The Mountain Network gets a bit of say in who they want on the show. We run the interviews and determine those elements, but obviously they know their content best, they know their researchers best, and so it's how we work through it. So in some ways, you know, and this isn't an excuse, but we are limited in how we do it, so we have to think creatively. How do we develop these relationships and reach out to these researchers who may have a great relationship with the Mountain Network? They may have just taken funding from the Mountain Network and don't know them that well, right? So how do we figure out that sense of, as you said, relationship building and trust building too, especially when, you know, these are people that are sharing information that, you know, they've dedicated a good chunk of their life to in many cases.
That's just right.
Well, thank you so much, Kyle. This has been a really good year, but I'm really looking forward to, especially with what we've just talked about, some of the changes that can happen for the next.
Yeah, you must see.
And that wraps up this episode of the Community Podcast Initiative. A special thanks to Gabrielle Piska, Eric Tanner, and Ethan Ward, and of course, to my co-host and co-coordinator, Kyle Napier. I'm Meg Wilcox. Thanks for listening. The Community Podcast Initiative is based out of Mount Royal University, which rests on the traditional territories of the Blackfoot Confederacy, the Tsuut'ina First Nation, and the Îyâhe Nakoda, as well as the Métis Nation of Alberta, Region 3. We're proud to be able to live, learn, and collaborate on this land as we work to bring together communities, perspectives, and stories. The CPI is powered by Shaw. You can learn more at thepodcaststudio.ca or find us on social media at CommunityPodYYC.